isolation, disconnection from peers, burnout. Many Christian leaders know how this feels. At The Living Church, we realized a long time ago that we weren't just here to be a magazine or a podcast, but a catalyst for connection. Through digital and in-person opportunities, we love creating a sanctuary for the shepherds, cultivating fellowship, continuity, and stability so that leaders can thrive and local churches can too. So how do we do this? Through lots of pastoral emails and phone calls, actually, with friends and subscribers like you, but also in public ways, webinars, conferences, our online covenant journal, teaching and preaching resources, and the Living Church podcast. We're called to encourage those on the front lines of parish ministry. So when you donate to The Living Church, you are funding this lifeline for connection and renewal. Whether it's $5, $50, or $5,000, your gift will not only continue the products and programs that you're enjoying right now, it will encourage and equip another leader like you. Donate to The Living Church today. You can go to livingchurch.org and click donate, or check out the link that's always in the show notes.
These family meetings or family gatherings are helpful reminders of a reality that is probably not in our consciousness lots of Sundays anyway, but that who we are people in relationship with other people who have been brought into the death and resurrection of Jesus.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Earlier this month, our editor, Mark Michael, returned a bit jet lagged, but not too bad, from a gathering of Anglicans that happens every 3 years. This is a meeting of the Anglican Consultative Council, or the ACC, as its friends call it. This year's gathering was June 27th to July 5th in Belfast, Northern Ireland. It also marked the first 100 days or so of Archbishop Sarah Mullally's ministry as Archbishop of Canterbury. We pulled together a special episode of the News Desk to talk about what Mark brought back from this International Communion reunion, who was there, what people were hoping for, and what came of it. We'll particularly discuss the reception and conversation around a document from the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Unity, Faith, and Order, known as the Nairobi-Cairo Proposals. So, okay, wait, step back. What is the Anglican Consultative Council exactly? We'll talk about that today. In fact, we begin by hearing what this international gathering of Anglicans has to do with you. And what are the Nairobi-Cairo Proposals, or NCPs, as we sometimes refer to them today? We're not going to take time to define these fairly complex documents. We've got lots of coverage on them elsewhere, and I'll put these links in the show notes so you can catch up if you want to. But even though today we're not going to spend a lot of time on definitions, there were two principal proposals as part of the NCPs that were debated a lot at the Anglican Consultative Council meeting and that we discussed today. And so I do want to highlight those really quick. One of those proposals is to limit the powers of the Archbishop of Canterbury and share them among other primates. This is attempting to meet several goals, among them addressing the colonial history of the Anglican Communion, as well as giving space for global South Anglicans and their leadership. Another proposal, hotly debated, is removing communion with the See of Canterbury as a primary marker of Anglican identity. So folks might call themselves Anglican and say, yeah, like we're fully Anglican together, even though not everybody has communion with the See of Canterbury in the same way as it has always been historically understood. So this is the proposal. If you imagine that this is part of trying to address the divisions within the communion, as well as Anglican family who are not currently in communion with Canterbury, well, you'd be right. You would win the prize. So those were the two big points of discussion, debate, argument, and I've painted with a broad brush. Again, to see the details, get to the show notes, see our other coverage on this. Special thanks, of course, to Mark Michael and to Matthew Ulver, Executive Director and Publisher of The Living Church, who joined me at the news desk today. In our bonus segment, we go from the communion gathering to the vestry meeting. How do you nurture vestry members in their capacity as spiritual leaders? Retired Episcopal priest and retreat facilitator Mark Smith has some ideas for you. Now, pack up a triple batch of your best potato salad. We are going to a big family reunion in Belfast, Ireland. What is the Anglican Consultative Council? Why does it meet? What was hoped for by those who attend it? What happened? What next? And why does this matter to you? We hope you enjoy the conversation. Matthew, Mark, thank you for joining me at the news desk today.
It's great to be with you.
Thanks so much, Amber. It's always good.
So today we have a little bit of a special concentration for the news desk. Mark just got back from Northern Ireland, where he was attending the 19th Anglican Consultative Council meeting. But first, I'm thinking about the listener to this podcast who may not really know a lot about the Anglican Consultative Council, but who is really curious, who's interested in learning more about global Anglicanism and how this connects to parish life and ministry. Because I know being in the Episcopal Church can often feel like you're on an island when it comes to other Anglicans until you go on pilgrimage or you have a strong relationship with a global sister church. So could both of you just pitch into this question? What does our conversation today, what could it potentially have to do with, let's say, a local priest's discipleship or ministry? Why does it matter to them?
I think about the ACC as sort of like the annual parish meeting of the Anglican Communion. So there are all sorts of initiatives that are helping to connect Anglicans around the world in common projects, evangelism, care for the environment, science, integrating faith and science, women's work, educational work, ministry to children and families. And there are lots of networks and commissions of the communion that are working in various ways, all of them composed of people from many different provinces who share a passion and they're sharing ideas and sponsoring projects together. So a big part of this meeting is just lots of people giving reports about good things that are happening in various parts of the Anglican Communion. And then also sometimes it's called upon to deal with, you know, issues that are happening in the family, as our annual parish meetings might be called upon to deal with. And so in this case, a major focus for this particular meeting was evaluating the Nairobi-Cairo proposals and the general issue that they're seeking to address, discussing them. I think going into the meeting, I thought there might be some action to enact one or more of their suggestions. That didn't end up happening, but there were 4 days of discussions about them. At the end of the day, probably a deeper understanding of the issues that they're trying to deal with.
Yeah, maybe another frame is, I think it's very easy for us, I mean, in my own local parish, Zion Episcopal Church in Oconomowoc, to think, you know, that's the local church. And I think it's helpful to remind ourselves that the Anglican approach to church actually sees the diocese as the local church, and dioceses are always in relationship and in communion with other people. And these family meetings or family gatherings are helpful reminders of a reality that is probably not in our consciousness lots of Sundays anyway, but that who we are people in relationship with other people who have been brought into the death and resurrection of Jesus. The way that that gets incarnated is through gatherings and through meetings. And as mundane as that sounds, that's the truth. It's interesting to me, even, you know, if you look in Paul's letters about different aspects of ministry to which people are called, he mentions administration multiple times. And that's like maybe the least alluring or exciting of those possibly, but it is the fact that a community of human creatures are bound together in relationship. And so that happens in these kinds of meetings. They can be done poorly or be done well, and they can be joyful and they can be enlivening or otherwise. But I think that it's just important to remind ourselves of how the church actually is and what we actually believe about the church. And that includes going to meetings. Meetings are part of the church.
Meetings are mundane, but mundane doesn't, you know, we don't necessarily cast aspersions on something by calling it mundane. The vast majority of things any of us do every day to stay alive, to be nurtured, to receive from God, to give to others are mundane, you know? So that's a great reminder. Meetings are also a place where people come bringing certain hopes and expectations, whether that's a family reunion or whether that's a vestry meeting. Everyone is bringing hopes and expectations to meetings. So I'm curious the different hopes or expectations people were bringing. If you want to share some hopes you had, Mark, I'm also curious about Archbishop Sarah Mullally's hopes and expectations, if she expressed any of those. And also IASCFO, so the Inter-Anglican Standing Commission on Unity, Faith, and Order. I did it in the first try. What kind of hopes or expectations that they might have been bringing, and any other hopes and expectations that stood out to you?
So I think maybe the first thing is when you have a meeting, you hope that everybody's going to be there who should be there. And there was a lot of anxiety about this because one of our first news desk issues had to deal with the launch of the Global Anglican Communion by GAFCON. And one of the provisions of GAFCON is that you wouldn't come to ACC meetings. And so for theologically conservative Anglicans in the Global South, they were kind of faced with a decision about whether they would participate or not. I was grateful that many of them did. Three provinces decided to boycott the meeting, Nigeria, Uganda, and Rwanda, but they've boycotted pretty much every meeting for the last 20 years. The other provinces who have been associated with GAFCON in the past either were present or would have been present, but for visa issues that were outside of their control. And they participated very actively in the meeting. I think another thing is, you know, what will the spirit of the meeting be? That's often more important than what actually gets done. Do people feel like they are respected and listened to? Is the debate polite? Does it accomplish things in terms of, like, people feel like the process is being honored? All these things are deeply important. And I think the spirit of the meeting was good. I think that a lot of people, the last ACC meeting I was at was in 2023, just after the Church of England had sort of made it clear that they were going to allow the blessing of same-sex unions. Justin Welby was kind of at a very anxious and difficult point in his leadership of the communion as Archbishop of Canterbury. It was a pretty tough meeting to be at. There were a lot of people who were very upset, and there was just a tension in the room, and that was not there. This is the first meeting that Archbishop Sarah Mullally has been at. There were a lot of questions about how would she be? How would she relate to such a large gathering of Anglicans? I mean, really the first gathering of this kind she's been part of. There were a lot of Anglicans that came to her installation in Canterbury in March, but there were a significant number that didn't, who were there at the meeting in Belfast. So that's a question there. I think IASCFO came hoping that certain parts of the Nairobi-Cairo proposals might be enacted, or at least that they would be understood and discussed. We'll talk more about that. I'm not sure that their hopes were really realized, partly through things beyond their control. And obviously there were some people who were coming who didn't like the Nairobi-Cairo proposals and wanted to see that they did not go forward. Maybe those people left most satisfied. I don't know.
Mark, do you think that you could characterize that group of people by saying that they were generally progressive, or they were generally very conservative, or they generally were hoping for this and gathered around sort of this ideology or this question, and that's why they didn't want the, or were there a variety of reasons why people did not want the Nairobi-Cairo proposals to succeed? What were the motivations for the people who were opposing or hoping that the NCPs would not succeed?
Maybe the most live concern, which rarely gets brought up, is that we have a large number now of Anglican provinces that were founded by GAFCON. And there is a fear among some theological progressives that if the Nairobi-Cairo proposals were passed And it was possible for provinces to become part of the Anglican Communion who were not in full communion with the See of Canterbury. This would create some kind of a backdoor mechanism for, say, the Anglican Church in North America to become part of the Anglican Communion. I frankly think that's a ridiculous suspicion because nothing changed about the process for becoming a member of the Anglican Communion. And the ACNA is basically running the global Anglican Communion, so they have no motivation to become the 43rd province with a 43rd of the influence of the Anglican Communion. But I think that for a certain kind of theological progressive, that's just a fear that's almost like it just goes to the bone in some way. I also think there was this suspicious narrative that we now have a female Archbishop of Canterbury, and now you're talking about limiting her power, and that this sort of looks sexist. I mean, again, I think this is pretty silly because the process that started the development of the proposals was started in 2022. In some ways, they were responding to issues created by Justin Welby. They had already been released when Sarah Mullally was announced as the Archbishop of Canterbury. So on the other hand, most people were just saying things like, we need more time, this is a big decision, we don't feel like we've had time to fully digest and discuss these. Only 4 of 42 provinces had released significant responses to them, which I think was disappointing, but you know, the communion obviously had not fully weighed this. It was clear in the meeting that some people just hadn't read the thing, and they were chastised by one of the members for that. But, you know, it is a 44-page document, and that may be hard for some people. But
yeah, Mark, you mentioned a couple reasons why people might be suspicious. I'm wondering how much you think a kind of instinctive existential anxiety just about distance from Canterbury in some abstracted way, how much of it actually can be attributed to that? Do you think that there were actually that many who were really concerned that the ACNA was going to jump in the back door? Was it they hadn't read it and it was like, Canterbury is who we are? Well, of course, we wouldn't want to limit that.
Yeah, I mean, we have relatively few identity statements in the Anglican Communion. And the classic description of the 1930 Lambeth Conference is the most common one. It's written into a lot of the constitutions and canons of the member churches. So it's an emotional touch point. I mean, and in some points, you know, as someone who's assuming that like people think about this in a post-colonial way, because that's the rhetoric that's often coming out. People are using very traditional ways of talking about this in the meeting, saying things like, Canterbury is our mother, and we may not want her to, like, tell us all exactly what to do, but we're a family, and, you know, clearly that language feels appropriate, which I found kind of surprising.
It's really interesting.
And the Church of England, as the mother church, that language has a long history of common usage. It's not informal
That's
statements,
right.
but I
That's
think
right.
people often speak in that way. Oh, yeah. The mother church.
But there's this fear of like, what are the consequences that we're not foreseeing here? Which, you know, in some ways is a reasonable fear to have about changing a description that's been around for 100 years. So, I mean, as an instinctive conservative, I totally understand that concern. I think that perhaps there has been an assumption, I do think this was changing, that when Global South provinces say, we're not in communion with the See of Canterbury, that they're just not being very serious or they're just not being very honest. And I think it was made clear that they do see it, that there's a difference of faith here and that difference of faith needs to be reflected in an acknowledgement that they have broken communion. And people would stand up on the floor of ACC and said, well, being in communion doesn't mean you're in agreement with each other, but they feel that to say we're in disagreement is not enough, that to also say our communion in faith has been broken by this significant decision, the rest of the communion needs to hear us and take that statement seriously. I do think there was progress in the rest of the communion hearing that wasn't really there before, and one of the final resolutions reflects that.
For more than 80 years, The mission of St. Francis Ministries has been to provide healing and hope to children and families. Inspired by the past and rooted in faith, their vision is to see lives and systems transformed. But they can't do it alone. You can join them in their life-affirming ministry. St. Francis provides a wide array of services ranging from foster care and adoption to preventative and residential programs. Join their mission and help ensure children and youth receive the care they need to heal and rediscover hope. Join their mission and help families heal and regain wholeness. Join their mission and help heal the world one child at a time. They have lots of ways you can make a difference. You can explore them all at stfrancisministries.org/mission. That's St. Francis, S-A-I-N-T, francisministries.org/mission. So do you feel, Mark, that there was enough space then, that there was more space than last time for Global South conservatives, which make up the majority of Anglicans around the world, that there was more space for them to have their say? And I mean, they're like a bunch of dozens of them are actually there giving their say, taking the floor. So that seemed to make a real difference to this meeting.
Yeah, I mean, the most significant discussion in the whole meeting was driven by a series of amendments proposed by delegates from the Global South Fellowship of Anglican Churches. So by conservative Global South. So they were setting the terms in some ways for some of the most serious debate. And I don't think that's always been the case. And in some ways, for them to be heard is more important than to pass one part of the NCPs or not. You know, there's a sense that we may get to work on the rest of this at a later point. But that builds trust when you're able to hear each other with honesty. And you know, the Archbishop sort of said fairly early on, I'm hearing from all of you that we need more time and that we need to kindle trust. And so let's not, she didn't say it directly, but she was implying, let's not try to bring something really substantive up for action at this point. And nothing really substantive was proposed, as far as I know. They were not, at least not reflected in the resolutions that came to the floor.
What happened at this meeting is quite instructive because, one, it shows the communion continuing to take seriously that these disagreements are substantive and require an equally serious response. But this represents just one of several possible serious solutions, right? So during Rowan Williams' archiepiscopacy in the Windsor process, what he articulated was language of intensification, of actually greater structure, instruments having more authority, and that didn't come to fruition. That kind of fizzled out. And this was another kind of proposal, which was to try and loosen things to make space for, many hoped would be further intensification, but through a different means.
Right.
One of the things that always struck me was that when a draft of the NCPs were presented to the primates meeting, I think in Rome, there was pushback on the Canterbury proposal, the reduction of Canterbury's role, but it was across the board. It was not just from more liberal provinces. Yeah, there were many.
There had been a proposal that there kind of one primate who wasn't the archbishop be given a kind of communion-wide remit, and they pushed back strongly against that. Yeah.
And I think for the like historic, emotional, but those things actually relate to tangible realities. The Archbishop of Canterbury still is, in many ways, a kind of diplomat. So when they come from England to your province, you know, England and the English church and its historic relationship with all its complexities is brought there after a manner of speaking. And that's actually not a small thing to their sense of their own history and identity, wrapped up as it is in colonialism. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, there's something positive there. And so I think it's helpful to keep in mind just how these things don't break down over simple conservative liberal lines. But I think what Mark said, that maybe one of the most important things that happened, these disagreements are about matters of faith. This requires serious engagement. It can't just be like, oh, we're going to walk together with a difference in faith. We have to do something more than that.
What happened in some ways reflects the significance of the Archbishop of Canterbury for the life of the communion, not just in the sense that for most of those present, retaining communion with the Archbishop is a central aspect of Anglican identity, but also in that the personality of the individual Archbishop has a major role in shaping the life of the communion. And the way that Justin Welby had a pretty domineering leadership style, and then under his leadership, the Church of England decided to change its practice around same-sex blessings. And he sort of invited this proposal in 2023. He basically said, take my power away from me, take me away from the center of the communion life. And it was under that kind of vocation that the NCPs got their start. And I ask if we really took up the work. But when he is no longer on the scene, and of course the Church of England has kind of pulled back in some ways from the path that it was on, and you have a new archbishop who is much more of a listener, much more of an incrementalist, has a less domineering style, everybody's like, well, we might be able to work with this, with things the way that they are now. It's not necessarily, perhaps, that we're out of communion with the Archbishop of Canterbury, is that we really didn't like working with that particular Archbishop of Canterbury. I'm not saying that, the GSFA has still said that they're not in communion with the current Archbishop, but there is a change in tone because of the change in leader. But for the long term, you know, there remains a need to update the description of the communion and some aspects of its life to reflect the reality of what we are now, which is a church that is much less dependent on the role of the Church of England than was once the case. So, you know, we may have an archbishop that everybody feels more comfortable working with right now, which is a blessing, but I don't think these issues are going away.
And I think it's interesting too, because I think there was a lot of prognostication and concern. I was one of those people that thought this, that outside of Archbishop Sarah as a person, just whether having a female Archbishop of Canterbury would create certain challenges with Global South provinces who either don't ordain women to the episcopate or have only done so recently. But that actually does not seem to have been much of an issue at all. And in fact, how different she is from Justin Welby is turning it, all the ways in which she's different are ways that strengthen her leadership, her ability to actually lead, and for people to trust her.
Yeah. And I commend, there's an excellent piece that Simon Walsh wrote for us, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, the first 100 days. And it really goes into some of these aspects of her leadership, which have been a blessing, not just in the communion, but in the Church of England as well. So
I am interested in conservative criticisms of limiting the power or circumscribing the power of the Archbishop of Canterbury and taking out, you know, communion with the See of Canterbury as a primary marker of Anglican identity.
The See of Canterbury is an ancient see. So the institution of the Archbishop of Canterbury predates any of the other instruments of communion by more than a millennia. There's a way in which we have always been the church that has been gathered around and sent out by the See of Canterbury as a blessing to the rest of the world. I mean, even if we update the description, we're still called the Anglican Communion. There are ways in which the Nairobi Cairo proposals push us towards a federation, lowering the kind of bar of a full Eucharistic communion. I don't think that that's ultimately their goal, but they do propose a weakening of those bonds as an intermediate step. That is a change in some ways, and some would see that as a change in the wrong direction. One of the challenges here was, I feel like even the people, the strongest supporters of the Nairobi Cairo proposals among the ACC members, which were probably folks from the Global South, were even they were saying, well, they are just structural changes and our real problem is doctrinal. So they don't actually get to the heart of the problem. Now, to have a doctrinal conversation, you know, to kind of, which I guess would mean kind of rehashing Lambeth 110, that's a serious issue and we probably should do it. We've been afraid to do it for 30 years. There was a lot of people saying, well, we need to go deeper and perhaps some structural realignment gets us in a better place to have it. But it is probably correct that we ultimately need to have these conversations. And, you know, do we have two teachings or do we have one teaching that half of the communion is choosing to ignore? I mean, these are unresolved questions, in my opinion. It is wise to recognize that they're not going to go away, and the progressives of the communion are not going to convince the conservatives anytime soon that they're not important. So ultimately, the Nairobi Cairo proposals never really aimed to address any of that. Perhaps for that reason, there was not really a ground game among the members to get them done. So you just kind of had people, you know, kind of asking questions and keeping talking. And, you know, perhaps, I mean, Martin Brown, you know, made an excellent point in his remarks that this takes a long time, these deep questions of identity, and we are in a better place to talk about them now than we were 3 years ago. So that kind of incremental progress is not to be discarded, even if, you know, there was no concrete action.
Yeah, you mentioned Martin Brown, who is a Roman Catholic ecumenical leader, and we've had him on the podcast. There were, I think, was it something like at least a dozen Christians there who aren't Anglicans. What's the significance of that? And I don't mean necessarily the philosophical significance or the reasons behind it, but them being there, how did that feel significant? And what did that do for the conversation to have witnesses to this family gathering who aren't in the same branch of the family in the same way, though they're also Christians? It reminds me of the 4th of July picnic that I just went to with this big fat Greek family. It was a big fat Greek 4th of July. I was the only non-blood family member there, and it was fantastic, and it was loud, and it was a little chaotic, and we had lamb kebabs, and then we also had a big pile of hot dogs, so it was amazing. But my presence had a particular effect there because of being a non-family member, quote unquote, as it were. But of course, in this gathering, you're all Christians. But what kind of effect did that have?
There have been ecumenical representatives for quite some time. Sometimes they have a particular area of expertise, like maybe there's an ecumenical partnership that's relevant to an area that a commission's working on that somebody stands up and talks about. There was a discussion about progress on particular ecumenical dialogues, and some of them spoke then. But I thought it was interesting, one of the amendments to the resolution about the Nairobi Cairo proposals specifically mentioned the work that the Roman Catholic Church has done through the Synod on Synodality and asking how this can be informed by that. And the representative from the Lutheran World Federation got up and said, well, we're doing our own project right now along the same lines of receiving the gifts of the synodality process and looking about how they can shape our lives as a federation. So maybe there's things we can learn from both the Roman Catholics and how the Lutherans have received what the Roman Catholics are doing that can inform our work. So it's, you know, this has been part and parcel of the way the communion has operated at these levels for a very long time.
Yeah. Were there some Eastern Orthodox people there who were like, no, guys, we're good, and we're waiting for all of you to come home. We're here. We're waiting for you.
Well, no one stepped up and said that. I know there was some Oriental Orthodox clergy there. I don't know if there was a representative from the Eastern Orthodox Church or not.
Okay. Just curious about that. Well, could I get a little bit of op-ed from both of you on the ACC meeting? If you both looked into the future, your own opinion of what some possible futures could be in terms of the Nairobi Cairo proposals specifically, and how the ACC and the Anglican Communion might move forward with these documents. What are some possible futures that you guys see?
Interestingly, I think a lot of this may actually fall to Archbishop Sarah, because the ACC meets infrequently. She calls the meeting of the primates. So the next two likely places where this can happen is the Archbishop of Canterbury, the primates, and the Primate Standing Committee. It may be somewhat ironic that the positive movement forward in dealing with these substantive disagreements may actually come through the Archbishop of Canterbury, because she's the only one sitting in a place who can act in these interim periods between when these meetings are called. And if the descriptions of her leadership are in any way indicative of how she will lead in the future, it seems that she actually, there's a high likelihood of success of her at least keeping people at the table, actually listening, so that people feel like they're being listened to, because they are. I think maybe one of the big questions is the GSFA seems very engaged. Thus, is it possible that they, in consultation with Archbishop Serra, might be able to bring a serious theological conversation back on the table some way? And maybe that happens first informally, maybe something like what we've been doing with communion across difference in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, I was just thinking
some
about
non-official
that.
Bodies decided to pick it up, mm-hmm. but do it publicly and mm-hmm. invite the leaders to come. Maybe that's a possibility. Maybe something analogous to that happens informally, but lots of people involved are actually people with authority who can then report to, you know, standing recognized bodies, the Synod of the Church of England, the primates meeting, that kind of thing. That's a bullish approach to possibilities, what could be positive.
I think that probably what will happen first is that there will be some more concrete plans for sharing of like symbolic and representative tasks of the archbishop with other primates. That seems to be definitely on the agenda for the primates meeting, and that's an important part of the Nairobi Cairo proposals. I think that a manageable lift, though it will be controversial, is updating the description of member churches of the communion in the ACC's constitution. That could just take the form of saying something like, the member churches are the ones listed in the schedule. But I think it currently says the member churches are those in communion with the See of Canterbury, and that's not actually true anymore. Some of the churches on the schedule are not part of the See of, in communion with the See of Canterbury. So I think that's a kind of thing that will have to be addressed. I think the other part of this that I was feeling uncomfortable about, especially as the meeting went on, is that the ACC is a pretty unrepresentative body in the sense that it, the small declining white provinces of the global north still have a lot more representation in the ACC. And there are two tiers, and the Church of Pakistan is 10 times as big as the Anglican Episcopal Church of Brazil, but they have the same number of delegates. And this was the first time in a long time that no African was elected to the standing committee. That does not look good. Now, what's probably happening is that the next five provinces of the Anglican Communion to be added are all from Africa. So that will reshape things as well. But I do think at some point, this is true of all of the instruments of communion. And every time we gather, it's apparent that the white people are still doing most of the talking and they're still winning more of the elections. I do think at some point there will need to be a deeper reckoning of this. And to me, if you really want to have a post-colonial future, that's an important part of it. Like, it's not just like, you know, using whatever the theological tropes about post-colonialism are. It's like letting people from Africa have a say and sitting down and letting them tell you what to do. And I just don't think we're quite there as a communion at this point.
A note for listeners that we're going to have a lot of articles, opinion pieces, a really great summary of the meetings from someone else who was there, Andrew Atherston. We're going to have this on our online journal Covenant, as well as on our webpage, livingchurch.org. We also have the links in the show notes for this episode. Mark, to close us out, you spent a week in Ireland. You've always got a story. So I just got to ask, did anything interesting happen to you in Ireland?
One of the most memorable moments, we went to Derry / Londonderry for the day away, for the pilgrimage day of Lambeth. And it's a beautiful city. It's also been sort of the symbol of sectarian tension in Ireland since the 1680s, since they built those famous walls around it. It's kind of been a flashpoint. But that was also the site of one of the most amusing and quintessentially Irish experiences I had, which was the Archbishop of Armagh and the Bishop of Derry and Raphoe leading a room of 200 Anglicans singing Danny Boy, because, of course, Danny Boy is the Londonderry heir. It's named for the place where we were. So that was great fun. So,
Mark, did you just say the Londonderry heir?
Yeah. I suppose. I also spent July 4th, the 250th anniversary of the United States in Bushmills in Northern Ireland. And I was thinking to myself, we never would have had a revolution were it not for all those Ulstermen that were here in America. So.
And you were there recalling how we all kicked the London Derriere 250 years ago.
Wow. Everything was decked in red, white, and blue, but it was all to celebrate the Battle of the Boyne. It was all to honor the Union Jack. So,
hilarious.
Ironic.
Hilarious. Well, I am so sorry you're missing your Guinness on tap, which I'm sure you are. But thank you so much for your reporting, Mark, and for the story and just the sense of the meeting that you brought back. And for more of a sense of that, visit our website, visit the show notes. We always encourage you to do so. I've been joined at the news desk today by Matthew Ulver, executive director and publisher, and Mark Michael, editor of The Living Church. Thank you both so much for joining me. Till next time.
Thanks very much.
Great to be here.
Preacher, are you looking for new resources to make preaching each week a little easier and, dare I say it, maybe even fun? Well, you can join Episcopal priests Father Jacob Smith and Father Aaron Zimmerman for the Same Old Song podcast. Same Old Song. Each week, they break down the lectionary texts for the coming Sunday with gospel insight, a few appropriate cultural references, sometimes slightly inappropriate, and a heart for the sufferer in the pew and the pulpit, all in half an hour. Check out Same Old Song wherever you get your podcasts, or check out the link in the show notes. Thanks for tuning in to today's special news desk. For our bonus segment today, we're zooming in from the conference center to the vestry meeting. The Reverend Mark Smith wrote a book that we reviewed for the magazine called Vestry Reflections, Cultivating Spiritual Growth in Church Leaders. And it's a series of short devotions that priests can use with their vestries. Someone who read it told me she really enjoyed this book, but she also said she'd love to hear more on implementation of these devotionals, and even more broadly, on how a priest develops spiritual leadership on a vestry. So I invited Mark on the show to share with us his top three tips for turning vestry meetings, yes, vestry meetings, into spiritual growth opportunities. The Reverend Mark Smith is a retired Episcopal priest who continues his ministry as author, speaker, and retreat facilitator. He's also author of Vestry Reflections, Cultivating Spiritual Growth in Church Leaders. We hope you enjoy the bonus chat.
Thank God I didn't get dressed up for this. Actually, I'm going fly fishing in a little bit.
Oh, good for you. I've never been fly fishing, but I'm a little bit jealous to be out in the Colorado rivers. Ugh.
I just like being out on the stream. If I catch a fish, that's coincidental.
I think I would be the kind of fly fisher who enjoyed eating a sandwich while standing in the river holding a fishing pole.
That works.
I brought you here, Mark, to ask you for your top three tips for developing spiritual leadership on the vestry. Would you first, though, just tell us a little something about why a vestry is special? Like, what makes a vestry different from, say, a board?
I think it's important to realize that we often recruit members to our vestries who bring particular skill sets, especially from the business world. Accounting, human resources, education, physical plant management. We also recruit people who've had previous either not-for-profit or investor-owned board experience. We need to set the stage, especially as clergy leaders, that serving on a vestry is not the same as serving on either a not-for-profit board or a commercial board. While they share similar responsibilities for the stewardship of financial, human resource, and capital within the congregation, they also are responsible with the clergy for the spiritual growth of the congregation. And that's a responsibility I think that we often overlook and don't spend enough time on. And hence the first tip, if you will. The first is to recognize that serving on a vestry is a call to ministry. It is a summons from the Spirit, punctuated by the will of the congregation, to serve in a decision-making role on behalf of the parishioners. It's a particular form of discipleship. It's not just going to work. It's not just going to another meeting. It truly is a ministry unto itself. I think it begins with, to the second point of what's important, is the capacity for critical listening. And by that, I mean, it's not simply refraining from speaking, but on the part of the vestry is rather a willingness to hear the unfamiliar, the unwanted, and the uncomfortable, to secondly comprehend their potential, and third, to interpret their meaning for the life of the congregation. We have to understand the needs of our people, their concerns, their wants, their expectations, their hopes, and their fears. And it's that critical listening that I think is essential, and again, too often overlooked as we focus on, let's make the decision.
I know, Mark, that a lot of the listening is built into the life of a vestry. For example, if you're doing a capital campaign, you're doing a rector search, you're doing something in which feedback from parishioners is part of what you're doing. It's already built in. How would you suggest, if a church is not in one of these critical periods, that a pastor help the vestry to grow in their capacity for critical listening? Is there an exercise that you might suggest, for example?
Actually, two things, frankly. One, using exercises that allow people to talk with each other and pull out or extract from that conversation the central element of the point the person was making. So in the complexity of a conversation you might have, that you and I might have, for example, what's the central theme that really caught my attention? The second, and this I highly advise, is regular listening sessions within congregations, not just the annual meeting, and not just task-specific meetings like for a capital campaign, but the opportunity just to listen to each other, to comment on the parish's life and growth, what gives people joy, what causes them concern. I think that activity taken at large strengthens the conversation that we have in difficult times in vestry meetings.
If you were to ballpark, here's a pie. The pie is our vestry meeting. And you were to say this much of the slice is going to be devotional time / spiritual development. This part of the slice is listening sessions / practicing those practical skills, relational skills. This percentage is business. This percentage is prayer. Could you ballpark a percentage of the pie for each of those?
I think the first thing I would do is hold a retreat session with the vestry and ask them, one, what's important for the vestry to do? Secondly, how do we focus our vision, our mission, and our values on the task at hand? So if I were breaking up a meeting, perhaps the first quarter of the meeting on spiritual growth, reflection, development, always organized around a topic that is relevant to the particular meeting at hand. So if we're talking about stewardship, you might have a devotion that centers on Jesus throwing money changers out of the temple, or Jesus reminding us that we ought to give unto Caesar the things that are due Caesar. The second thing I do is to take about 5% to remind people of vision, mission, and values of our congregation and how those might be challenged in the particular meeting ahead. Mm-hmm. Third thing, the remainder of the meeting, I do two things. One, we set the agenda and we time it. So the reading of the and approval of the minutes, that should take not more than 2 minutes. The approval of the agenda, not more than 60 seconds. And then time out each of those items so that by the time we're done, we've spent roughly an hour and 45 minutes, perhaps 2 hours. The caveat to that, Amber, is that it depends on the history, the culture of the congregation, and also upon the meeting time. If you're meeting at 7 o'clock on a weeknight, most people really don't want to go to 9 o'clock. If you're meeting on a Saturday morning, perhaps people are more willing. to take a little bit more time.
Well, Mark, I've heard that we should see the vestry as a call to ministry, build a capacity for critical listening. What is your third and final tip for us for growing the spiritual leadership of our vestries?
I think it is the challenge of inspiration. And there's a quote I'd like to share that is among my favorites. It's from President Theodore Roosevelt. "Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to take rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy much or suffer much, because they live in the great twilight that knows not victory nor defeat." And while very much from the secular world, I think it speaks volumes to vestries to recognize that their responsibility is not fundamentally the maintenance of the status quo. That's not the gospel of Jesus Christ. Their role is to be about prudent, informed risk-taking on behalf of not only their congregation, but on behalf of the community, and in a larger sense, literally on behalf of the gospel. It's to think both inside the box and outside the box.
Mark, thank you so much for taking time out of your fly fishing day to come on for this bonus chat.
Amber, thank you so much. And I leave you with a beautiful quote from the spiritualist and theologian Henri Nouwen: "Leadership can only be honest if it takes the form of service."
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. This episode was edited and mixed by the team at Sound On, Sound Off. Learn more about their work at soundonsoundoff.com. In 2 weeks, what do UAPs, space travel, and life on other planets have to do with the gospel? We consider the stars and other extraterrestrial life while pondering theology and pastoral care in light of science with astrophysicist and pastor, the Reverend Dr. David Wilkinson. Until then, I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.